jealous, warmer than the summer night.
Isn't that a beautiful voice? That's Libby York singing. You want to hear Libby York talking? Hi, Libby.
Hi, Richard.
You really are one of my favorite singers, and one of the, you know, this town is filled with great jazz performers and singers of all stripes, and Libby is not only one of my favorites, she is one of the best. She will be playing at Winter's Jazz Club Tuesday, and after that, a very special place. But so what's new? You're back in town, are you?
Haven't seen you in a while. Yeah,
well, it's been almost exactly, you know, Facebook is so weird. I mean, I don't like it, but I have to use it. And so all of a sudden it said, 1 year ago today, and there's Libby York. And I thought, wait, they made a horrible mistake. She's on the show tonight.
It was a year.
And you would come back and you were going to do Winters again.
Probably, yeah.
You split your time. You have had since you were a young woman growing up in Rogers Park, kind of a wanderlust, haven't you?
Yes, I discovered Key West, Florida many years ago and bought a house down there. So having grown up in Chicago, I realized, okay, the winter is not for me anymore.
Yeah, I know it is. Happy Father's Day to all you fathers out there.
Yeah, happy Father's Day.
You lost your father when he was relatively young, but your parents were a huge, huge influence on your musical career, weren't they?
Well, they both played piano and sang, and I heard a lot of Sinatra around the house, and Perry Como. My mother loved Perry Como.
And Rosemary Clooney.
And Rosemary Clooney, yeah.
And they were the kind of parents who, when you didn't start out with a career in jazz, you had such a fascinating life, Libby. You started out with a career in restaurants, basically, did
right.
you not?
Well, first I was a teacher.
That's right, that's
then
right.
Then I decided to try opening a restaurant, the Back Porch Cafe in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and it's still there 40-some years later. I don't own it anymore, but it's still there.
When you go back, how do they greet you there?
Oh, yes. It's great. I was just there actually in May, and it was so fun to see, you know, everyone having such a great time, and they're doing flaming house coffees. And
well, but you modeled it too. It was one of the, it was a sort of pioneer in the whole kind of Alice Waters natural food movement, wasn't
right.
it?
Right in the, whatever that was, 74, and we were doing farm to table. And right, like, just as Alice Waters was doing at Chez Panisse in Berkeley.
And you were inspired, too, by the famous, maybe, there's, if I remember it, there are people out there who remember it, too, the famous Fanny's restaurant in Evanston.
Yeah, we talked about that. Some of your listeners remember Fanny's in Evanston, and she would come to the table, and it was always kind of, I remember thinking, oh, the restaurants, it's kind of like showbiz, you know? So I tried restaurants first and then moved to showbiz.
What I remembered about it, she was famous for, like, her spaghetti sauce, wasn't she?
Right. They have it, or they had it frozen.
That's right. I remember that. It was one of the first things from a restaurant that I ever remember seeing in a store.
Fanny's spaghetti sauce. Yeah, it's great.
What dragged you away? You're on the East Coast, and you had sort of sung in high school at, where'd you go? Sullivan, right?
Sullivan yeah.
High School. And we're always interested in music. But what drew you to, you know, the bright lights and crazy club scene in Manhattan?
You know, I started singing with a guitarist who was playing in the Village, and, you know, always wanted to sing Cole Porter and Gershwin and, you know, Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer. And that was it. Once I started doing that, I just never got tired of it. You know, it's really been a life's work.
Well, that's something I admire, your passion, because those were, you know, any young or relatively not so young coming to Manhattan to make a mark as a singer, those were some pretty lean years for you, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's not exactly a profession you go into to make a lot of money.
Yeah, it still is. Yeah, it never make a lot of money.
But yeah, it's a blessing to have something you really love to do, you know.
After the break, I want people to really hear you. You are playing Winters. You played Winters last year. This is a special kind of show for you. It's labeled Something Cool, and it's your nod to the inspirations of the aforementioned Rosemary Clooney, June Christie, and especially, and I'm so taken with the way you discovered one of Chicago's great singers and one of its most influential singers, Frank Derone. How did you discover Frank Derone as a young woman?
You know, it's so funny. I was a student at Sullivan High School, and there was a record store on Morse Avenue, real near Ashkenaz.
The famous old deli.
The wonderful Ashkenaz. And somehow I got a hold of June Christie's Something Cool record and Frank Derone's first record. This was, I think his first record came out in 59. And, you know, I think it was the first time I thought, oh, listen to that. That's how it's really supposed to sound. He's great. And he was a great guitarist also.
And later in life, you didn't meet Frank around that time, but when you eventually came back to Chicago as a professional singer, you met Frank.
Yeah,
and
it was really a thrill to meet him and actually sing with him at the Jazz Showcase. And his wife Joan has become a good friend. And
did you tell him when you first met him, Frank, I bought a record of yours?
Oh yes, absolutely. I told him right away.
You think you were the first person to ever tell him that? Just joking. Just joking. You're going to hear more from Libby York singing and talking after a short commercial break. I will start it off with telling you Get Real in the Morning with Larry Potash, Robin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad. So funny, I was asked to make the 8th grade graduation speech, what do they call it, commencement address, at my old grammar school on Friday. And in the audience was Paul Conrad, because he's got 3 kids who go to LaSalle School. I hope I didn't embarrass the entire room. They're the entire WGN Morning News team. They're on from 4, the ungodly hours of 4 to 10 a.m. We'll be right back.
Makes me treat you the way that I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you?
Welcome back. That again is Libby York from one of her 3 CDs. Libby will be playing Tuesday at Winter's Jazz Club, which is just a stone's throw from here. She is also playing, this is a really interesting and I think very exciting venue. It's the Cliff Dwellers Club, the normally private Cliff Dwellers Club at 200, at the top of 200 South Michigan Avenue. How did that come about, Libby?
You know, I went to see a friend who had played there, Alyssa Allgood, wonderful singer, young singer, and met a few people, and I thought, boy, this place is really special. And I had always heard about the Cliff Dwellers, you know.
Yeah, it is a remarkable, remarkable place. I'll keep reminding people that's Friday night, July 19th. But in putting together the show that you're performing Tuesday at 7:30 and 9:30 at Winter's Jazz Club, this Something Cool, a nod to your inspirations, June Christie, Frank Derone, and Rosemary Clooney. Knowing you, it's more than, hi, this is another song by Frank Derone. I mean, you're going to talk about the reasons that these, and the ways in which these people influenced you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're, this is really the beginning of my, not even my career, but just my listening to this kind of music. And yeah, they were all so influential. Oddly enough, Rosemary Clooney later than the other two, because her CDs with Warren Vaché, the great cornetist. Then I got to meet Warren, and he's on my last 2 CDs. So, you know, I kind of patterned some of my recording on those Rosemary Clooney, like
I simply like to listen to music and I can't perform at all, but is it inspired by their phrasing, by their song selection, by their stage mannerisms, or all of that kind of?
I would say for me more, since I got to know them in recordings, phrasing, and they swing. You know, so it's definitely jazz, and they're just inventive, all of them. Rosemary Clooney was just astonishingly simple, and yet she meant every word, you know, every lyric.
Hmm.
She said once, I'm a singer of fine songs who works with jazz musicians.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
She's not a bebopper, a scat singer, but boy, she sure can sell a lyric, you know.
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing to, have you themed shows before?
I have. People, club owners seem to like themes.
Why? Well, because it brings up other names that people can identify. If they don't know the specific performer, at least they can say, well, you know, she does the Rosemary Clooney songs. I mean, it's a marketing kind of thing, is it not?
I think so, and it gives people an idea of what you're doing, you know. I also love when I'm working with musicians like Steve Million on piano, who's great, and Larry Cohat on bass. It's great to just let loose and improvise and have fun with the songs.
Yeah. Give me an idea of the state of, I've asked you this every time you've ever been on one of my radio shows, and you've been
the
on
the state of jazz music
in Chicago.
Well, it's thriving, I would say. I don't know. It's you know, it's not an easy road to go. And but there's a lot of wonderful musicians in this town, that's for sure.
See, one of the things is, as you know, I go back far enough to remember a considerable number of venues where one could perform. And that seems to be, except Winners is relatively new, it seems to be fewer and fewer over the years, or at least fewer than there were 20 years ago. But that has done nothing to prevent young people from taking up jazz.
That's true.
It's a passion, then. It is certainly not a commercial consideration.
And it's quality music.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's never going to die. It may not be in the pop culture anymore, but the people who love jazz really love jazz.
And I know, I mean, you do attract younger audience members too. It's not it's not just a bunch of people like us. It's crossed over to the new generation who, I think, you know, whether they heard it on their parents' CD players or not, or were exposed to it in school, it is attracting, I think, a new generation.
Oh yeah. And, you know, there's so many jazz programs in the university now that really helps keep the music alive and helps keep young people going. You know?
Have you ever taught?
I have.
I mean,
you were a
teacher when you were young, and you weren't teaching jazz, but have you taught any of these jazz classes? I think you'd be really inspiring.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, what I have to teach is probably many years on the bandstand. You know, someone else could do a better job of teaching technique or theory.
But don't you think that would be a valuable lesson, though? I think that would be an incredibly interesting and worthwhile and valuable class to take life on the bandstand, because you've paid your dues.
Yeah, you're right. I should probably create a little workshop at some point, you know, because I love working with young people. And, you do learn a lot just by doing.
Sure, sure. Well, and you know, there are certain sacrifices that one has to make, too. You know, you're not going to, you know, maybe you can discover Key West and go down there in the wintertime and sing there, but you're not going to have a huge IRA, and you're not going to be able to retire.
Right.
Why would a singer retire anyway, except if they lose their voice?
Can't think of any reason other than if you can't do it anymore.
And look at Tony Bennett.
Isn't that great?
There's a big piece in the paper today about Tony Bennett. Again, Libby's going to stay after the commercial, and I promise I will allow her to pick out an entire song so you can get the full dose of Libby York. She is going to be this Tuesday night at 7:30 and 9:30 at Winter's Jazz Club, which is a relatively new jazz club, but I think thriving here. I think they have found an audience. It's right over here. It's downtown. It's right over, I can't remember the exact address, but go to the website. You'll find it. Also, go to the website, LibbyYork.com. That's LibbyYork.com. And I'm assuming you have this information about the Cliff Dwellers thing.
Yes, everything is on there, all the dates. There are quite a few dates coming up in the summer. So
fabulous, because you're a summer girl here. In winters, she's in Key West.
I don't do winters in Chicago.
She doesn't do it anymore, because she's a native Chicagoan, can afford not to spend. She's learned a lesson, not spend the winter months here. It's bad for her voice. Also, you can get Libby's, you can order her CDs. How many now?
Four of them. Yes.
That, I want to talk to you a bit about the nature of the recording business, because that has imploded in the last 10 years, I think. It was relatively easy to make CDs years ago and get them made and get them out. And I don't think it is anymore. So stay tuned for, you got to listen to some commercials, and Roger Badish, who is a huge fan of Fanny's, as he came in and told us, and some now mysterious Brigadoon-like restaurant in Michigan where they still sell Fanny's spaghetti sauce.
We're going to find out who's still selling.
Some, call in if you're in Michigan and have nowhere Fanny's spaghetti sauce can be had. We'll be back. Libby York is here for a few more minutes, and Libby York, Chicago-born, Chicago-raised, but she has been all over the place. She lives some of the year in Key West, Florida, where she's had done for decades now, but also is very intrigued. In Key West, you sang for Tennessee Williams, didn't you?
Actually, I met Tennessee, but didn't sing for Tennessee. He was already passed.
That's his loss.
Well, you know, there was a time in Key West when you would see the likes of Tennessee walking the street, you know.
It's changed a bit.
It's changed.
Yeah. But in New York, when you were in New York, you were at a dinner party, and Leonard Bernstein asked you to sing for him.
And that
now actually, that's pretty cool.
That actually happened in Key West.
Oh, it did?
Yeah. He had become friends with friends of mine from the opera in Rome, and he was there for dinner. And after dinner, he said, "Libby, let's go to the piano and play some blues." And, you know, I sang with him, and he played piano, and it wasn't until afterwards I thought, oh, my Lord, I just sang the blues with Leonard Bernstein.
I cannot think of Leonard Bernstein any place other than New York. That's my problem.
He used to hang out in Key West a little bit.
He was something.
Back in the day.
You don't mind hanging out in New York. You like
I love it. I'm actually there more and more lately. I'm going to be there quite a bit. Next year I just played wonderful little club on West 10th Street called Mesro. Huh. And it's, you know, I lived there for quite a while.
Sure.
And so it's kind of like coming back home, another home.
Yeah, Chicago is always going to be
Chicago's
your home.
Always hometown.
You once told me, when I sing, I bring all of my life experiences to a song, and that includes Chicago, which is always home. Libby is going to be at Winters Jazz Club. Go to wintersjazzclub.com. She'll be there this Tuesday night. Shows at 7:30 and 9:30. And then in July, Friday, July 19th, she'll be at the Cliff Dwellers. It's called Live Jazz on the Cliff. And it's one of the most astonishing venues in the Midwest. It's an amazing place. It is worth it to go see and hear Libby. It's also worth it to see the place.
It is a beautiful place.
It's a perfect one.
Private club,
punch.
But it'll be open to the public for a $10 cover, so that's real special.
God, $10. That's like a cup of coffee. I want to leave you with a Libby York song. Libby, you've selected the song. Introduce it for us.
Oh, Like Someone in Love. This is with the great Frank West, who was from the original Count Basie band. And I got to record this with him and also perform with him at the Triad Theater in New York. He's now passed, but
He lives on with his music, though.
He sure does. Yeah, he's one of the greats.
It's great to see you. I'll promote that Cliff Dwellers thing later in the summer. Here, drive home safely.
Thanks.
Here, ladies and gentlemen, is Libby York.
Lately I seem to go out gazing at stars. I keep hearing guitars like someone in love. Sometimes the things I do astound me. Mostly whenever you're around me. Lately I seem to walk as though I had wings. I'm bumping into things just like someone in love. Each time I look at you, I'm limp as a glove, and I'm feeling like someone in love. Lately I seem to go gazing at stars. I'm hearing guitars like someone in love. Sometimes the things I do astound me. Mostly whenever you're around me. Lately I seem to walk just as though I had wings. I keep on bumping into things just like someone.
Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. You may remember, you loyal listeners of this show, for some time, some years ago, we had a theater critic on this program named Zita Moore. Her parents are Natalie West, the actress, and Keith Moore, the attorney and eventual super seniors golf champion, I'm assuming. They are really old and dear friends of mine, and Zita was an extraordinary. People would write after she would do her reviews and say, in the classic GN fashion, you should use that woman more on your show. She's more interesting than you are. So, okay, I'll try and do my best. Where is Zita, you guys, and welcome to the show.
Zita is in the air as we speak on her way to Tokyo.
To do what?
She's visiting a friend from college and a family that we know through my sister-in-law.
Oh, my God. Now, you two, it's great to see you. You invited me, and we don't see each other enough, that's for sure. I was really happy to hear from you when you invited me to a party that's going on. In a couple weeks, called
June 27th,
called Cocktails and Carrots at a place called Urban Autism Solutions. And I know that your son, Jack, who I have known since he was born, has, what is the correct phrase now? Is it something like on the autism spectrum?
I've, since he was diagnosed, have been willing to say he's autistic.
Right.
But many, many people do prefer to say he has autism.
Or he's
on the spectrum, or he's on the autistic spectrum.
Now, this came, I don't remember exactly when he was diagnosed. How old was he?
I think when Jack was around 3.
And is that the usual age?
Now, you know, so many years later, I think people are able to see the symptoms and diagnose their children much earlier.
Well, because, and you two would know much better than I, because this has become a much more, whether it's more easily diagnosable or more prevalent since in the 20-some years since Jack was born. Am I right?
I think the statistics, the last one I remember was that 1 in 59.
Wow.
Or something like that. And then the other significant statistic about autism is that the ratio of males to females is quite high. I think... again, my memory, if memory serves, there are about 5 male kids on the spectrum versus 1 female on the spectrum.
And there
so
is
it's an interesting skewing of the population in that way.
One of the things, as you know, my friend Mike Royko, one of his grandkids is severely autistic, so severely that he had to be institutionalized, and the family, the wonderful, his wonderful parents, David and Karen, have been going back and forth from Cleveland to visit with him, and he's sort of pretty non-communicative. I mean, at least I have communicated with Jack. Jack seems to like me.
Jack,
maybe it's just me, but
I mean, Jack is definitely on the higher end of the functioning of the autism spectrum. Jack taught himself how to take the suburban bus system. We lived in Highland Park, and I was at home one afternoon, and he'd gone on one of his long walks, and I tracked him down to Hubbard Woods, and I went to pick him up, and I said, Jack, the time didn't make sense to me. He'd gotten a long way in a short period of time, and he was about 10 or 11 years old at the time. I said, Jack, how did you get here? He said, on the bus. So he figured out how to do things, and then we eventually he was taking the Metro train up to Waukegan and doing other things that we were testing his boundaries at an early
age.
One
of the things that the Roykos had told me, and that I know you two, who and both of you, David and Karen, and you, Natalie and Keith, have been about as hands on as parents, I mean, investigating the best place to go to school, the best services, the best people for Jack to talk to. But it occurred to me, and frighteningly, that eventually, as someone on the spectrum gets older, there's like nothing.
Well, that's a problem that all of these kids face, because we're very lucky in the Chicago metropolitan area that the school systems tend to have good, better than if elsewhere, special ed programs for kids sure. of all different kinds of disabilities. And we live in Highland Park and have lived there for 22 years.
Well, and the reason you went to, the reason you moved to Highland Park, if I recall, you know me, I could brain is mush most of the time, but it was you were living in LA. Natalie was had been on Roseanne. You were working as a screenwriter. You needed to get Roseanne kind of petered out, and you wanted to find the best services available in the country for Jack, and you found them up there.
Was actually Zita. Zita presented...
Their daughter.
Yeah, Zita Jack's was 2 years sister. Older than Jack and was 5 years old when we moved back to Chicago in 1997. And Natalie found Cove School in Northbrook.
Sure.
And Zita was admitted to Cove School as the youngest kid there when she was basically in kindergarten age. And Zita's not... on the autism spectrum, never was, but she had learning disabilities and severe delays. And Natalie found Cove School for Zita. And so when we moved back, it was all a matter of trying to get a house that was close enough to Cove School for her to go to.
Wow.
And Cove School is tucked in behind Northbrook Court. And if you're driving on the spur from the Edens to the 294, you pass Cove School on the right, and it's I think it was the one of the oldest schools in the United States for K through 12 kids with disabilities.
Well, whatever they learning did, disabilities. Whatever Zita's learning disability was, you could have, in a way, you could have fooled me. Not that I'm a teacher. I mean, Zita is just an incredibly talented writer and very, very creative. Now, young woman,
yes.
But Jack needed more attention.
At that time, Cove School was not equipped to deal with people with autism. I think maybe that's changed over time. I really don't know.
You would think.
But Jack was falling through the cracks.
Whew.
And, you know, we finally found the right place for him. But, Rick, to get back to what you said about after kids go through high school.
Yeah.
What happens.
Right.
And where Jack is now and what the Tracy family has started is a place for young adults on the spectrum to come and be, to work at the farm.
And live. And to try to have...
And to have social access.
After the news, we're going to talk to Julie and Michael Tracy, who founded this Urban Autism Solutions in 2012 out of their own, the manifestation of their own need for one of their children, and they're the ones who are throwing this party to which you can go. Whenever this topic comes up on the air, and I've had David Royko on the air talking about it, I hear from a lot of people out there, one of the problems is that finding, it is difficult, is it not, Natalie and Keith, Natalie West and Keith Moore, because you've been through it. It is sometimes so difficult to find the resources, and for other people, and I know you're part of that larger community, there are some people who are kind of embarrassed to be looking. You know, I think that's one of the real tragedies of this thing. I'm going to have you after the news sort of formally introduce Julie and Michael Tracy. We're going to get them on the phone and talk about Urban Solutions, but this place for you is a heaven for your son, is it not?
Well, yes. Jack now, when he has a choice between coming to Highland Park and spending the night at our house or staying at 1212, the main house of the organization, they have so many activities, especially during the summer, that he'll bypass coming home. He'd rather be with his friends.
Wait a minute. You haven't made the offer to spend some time with Uncle Rick, have you?
Well,
he'd flee from that, I'm sure. He'd flee from that.
Jack is barely verbal, but he would express himself strongly.
Yeah, I've talked to Jack. I like Jack a lot. I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but all through his adolescence. No, he didn't communicate much, but what we did communicate was special to me. We're going to get some commercials in and then some news, and then we'll come back and talk to Julie and Michael Tracy and continue talking to Natalie West and Keith Moore about Urban Autism Solutions, which is obviously changing lives in very, very profound ways. We'll be back. I have known Keith Moore and Natalie West for, again, I guess I can say now, most of my life. Keith is an attorney and very talented amateur golfer, and Natalie is one of the best actresses to ever grace a Chicago stage. They sent me an invite. We don't see each other enough. That's one of the problems. They sent me an invitation to a party on June 27th, a gathering, Carrots and Cocktails, brought to you by Urban Autism Solutions, and I'm certainly planning to go, and the public is invited, and I'll give you all sorts of details. But I was asking them about it and decided, wow, I know so many of my friends, Karen and David Royko, have an autistic son who is sadly has to live in Cleveland. They may move out there. And Natalie and Keith have an autistic son, Jack, who has been a buddy of mine since he was a little baby. And they told me about, I said, what's Jack doing? And they brought up Urban Autism Solutions, and so I'm so pleased to have Julie and, or I don't know if you're both on the phone, Julie and Michael Tracy, who started this organization in 2012. Are you on the phone?
Hi, Rick. Yes, this is Julie and Mike. We're both here.
Hi, Julie and Mike. This is my affection for Natalie and Keith is unbounded, and my affection for you two starting this thing. This is, and it's even with my interest in autism, it's flown a little under the radar for me. Can you tell me why and how you started this, and then we'll get into, you know, specifics about what you do?
Absolutely. We would love to tell you about our organization. Well, you know, as you can imagine, Rick, like most things, this Urban Autism Solution started from a personal need in our own family.
Sure.
Mike and I are the proud parents of two young men. We have a son, Joe, who lives in California. He's married to his wife, Emily. And we have our younger son, John, who's 26 years old. John was diagnosed with autism, you know, back in about 1994. And, you know, much like Jack, this was back in the days when people really weren't talking about autism.
No kidding.
And, you know, John was one of these really interesting, kind of quirky kids who was really hard to describe or hard to diagnose. He didn't have necessarily classic features of what people thought of as autism back in those days.
Sure.
But he had a lot of trouble getting through the day in a smooth way. I think that sums it up. John went through, we raised our family in Glenview. We loved Glenview. Our boys both went to the public schools. John made it through his first couple of years in high school, but then really, really started to have significant trouble at that time. Mm-hmm. So he attended the wonderful Sonia Shankman Orthogenic School in Hyde Park, and we had our struggles there as well, but he ended up doing very, very well in that setting. It was a wonderful residential program for students, bright students who have social and emotional and learning difficulties. However, there was a time when John was hospitalized and psychiatrically hospitalized and really, really struggling for stability. And it was really during the summer of 2011, he was at Rush University Medical Center for over 6 weeks, and we didn't think he was going to make it. It was very, very challenging time for our family.
I'll bet.
And, we looked around and said, you know, even when John gets out of here, if he gets out of here, you know, what is going to come next once he's stable and back on his feet? We looked around and really didn't see much of anything in terms of programming for housing or jobs.
Julie, let me interrupt you for a second,
yeah.
Julie Tracy. That, to my mind, is one of the grand tragedies of this whole thing, that people with children, autistic children of a certain age, when they did heretofore look around and say, okay, well, I know it happened to the Roycos. What is going to happen? What can we do now? And you and your husband, Michael, had the wherewithal to figure it out and then to do something about it.
Well, you know, we were essentially, I think, you know, we were desperate.
Yeah.
We did take some trips. We looked all over the country. And remember, this was back in 2011.
Right.
I'm happy to say now that, you know, there are programs that are really springing up and there are more services, I think, available. But, you know, even 6, 7, 8 years ago, really there wasn't a fit necessarily for kids like John and kids like Jack. We looked at some residential programming in Illinois and we were frightened by it. We went to see programs in California. We looked at programs in Arizona. And we did a lot of just thinking and planning and learning. And from those models, we're grateful to those folks who started the programs that we went to observe. We drew what we thought was the best of the best ideas and just dug in and started setting up something that we thought would be suitable not only for John, but for others like him, so that we could create a community of, you know, lifelong learners and residents long after we were gone.
Well, and giving people, that is another element of it. I don't like to dwell on the whole, after we're gone, what happens to these people? And I think you were coming up, I think the word solutions in your Urban Autism Solutions Network is incredibly prescient and precise. The website is urbanautismsolutions.com, and you have programs and services and consulting and vocational training and even residential places. Julian, Mike Tracy, let me interrupt you for a second to ask Keith and Natalie, Keith Moore and Natalie West, how did you, as you were searching, dear old friends, for something for Jack's future and contemplating Jack's future, how did you find Urban Autism Solutions?
A good friend of mine invited me to a talk at Urban League. Is that
the Urban League?
Yes, the Urban League. Sure.
And that's where I first saw the wonderful Julie Tracy speak. And she talked about a model that she had in mind. And I was lucky enough to be there at the beginning.
It must have, Natalie, seemed like the proverbial ray of sunshine. I mean, you, as Julie just described, you know, going around the country and seeing places that would scare them and places.
Yeah, I was still in denial at that point. I always thought somehow, some way, we're going to figure it out for Jack. But I've been lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. So.
Julie, when you and Mike began this, what was the initial, did you have a building, did you have a space, was your initial aim to, because I am assuming it has expanded dramatically over the last 6 or 7 years, it must have started modestly, yes?
Oh, very much so. We essentially did our homework. We looked at the areas that were causing the biggest needs for young adults. And, of course, we used John as our model. He was sort of our prototype.
Sure.
But we knew that John had made so much progress at the orthogenic school. He was graduating with a job. He was loving, loving, loving the city, and we love the city, too. We've always been drawn to the city. And we knew we wanted to start our programming here in Chicago. We knew that we needed a strong medical partner to provide psychiatric care for our clients because 60 to 70% of young people with autism have mental health concerns.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really organized service delivery around that fact yet, surprisingly, but we knew that was going to be important. And that's one of the benefits of when John was in the hospital. We became very familiar with the Near West Side, and we fell in love with the UIC neighborhood and the Little Italy neighborhood. We knew it was pedestrian friendly and relevant and near these medical partners and universities. So we basically started with the biggest area of his needs, which were housing, employment, and social opportunities. And we just, you know, like I'm sure as Natalie has described and Keith, Mike and I as parents, just picked those areas and dug in and started creating programming around that. So our very first model, we wanted to have a residence for young adults that served as more than a residence. We wanted to bring the community into us. We knew we needed space that would serve as a place of hospitality and welcome and serve as a site for organizing meetings and parties and get-togethers, because our young folks tend to be very isolative.
Sure.
And we wanted to sort of make sure that the world came to them as well.
Well, it's that whole notion.
Be out in the world quite a bit.
It's the whole notion of creating community. I have to take, Julie and Michael Tracy, I have to take a short break, but we'll be back in a couple minutes to continue this conversation. And again, ladies and gentlemen, the website is UrbanAutismSolutions.com. Welcome back. I'm on the phone with Julie and Mike Tracy, the two people who founded Urban Autism Solutions in 2012, and I'm in studio with my old dear friends Keith Moore and Natalie West, whose son Jack is involved in this remarkable organization, along with the Tracy's son John. In essence, you can get a ton of information at the website, which is UrbanAutismSolutions.com. But in essence, what this does, what it is doing, is providing young adults with autism social, residential, and vocational solutions to their lives, and in so doing, creating a community that I have to think, and you two tell me this first, Nat and Keith, is incredibly empowering for the people involved.
Well, absolutely. I think Jack is a young man who has agency and feels that he is a part of his community, and he's doing very well.
Yeah, he's an enthusiastic participant, and what Julie and Mike are able to do are to create activities. Some as simple as every Wednesday night visiting a different restaurant in a different neighborhood, and the guys, you know, volunteer to do this, and Mike leads the way, and they experience the city, and then in the summer it's, you know, whatever street fair is happening on a Saturday night and other things, just to break the boundaries for these guys.
Well, I also think where this fundraising party is going to take place is the Growing Gardens Farm. Julie and Mike, tell me about that. What is that?
Well, in a nutshell, Rick, Growing Solutions Farm is an acre and a half produce farm in the middle of the Illinois Medical District. Every summer, we serve up to 30 young people, predominantly from the west side, from very low-income neighborhoods. These are Chicago public school students with mild intellectual disabilities and autism, and they learn vocational skills. We teach them transferable job skills. We basically use agriculture as our means and our medium, but we're really giving them their first opportunity for paid employment. So we're part of the One Summer Chicago program. All the kids earn a paycheck, and hopefully, often we found is the case, this is leading to employment for them when they do leave high school and when they're in high school. So it's a great program. We have a farm stand every Saturday in the Green City Market in the West Loop. We have a farm stand at the farm on Wednesdays. It's also run by our young adults. And as you mentioned, we have this great party coming up on Thursday, June 27th, and our wonderful executive director, Heather Tarkson, is putting together. We're serving Kirsten cocktails from 5 to 7 at 2200 West Campbell Park Drive, and we'd love to have people come out and join us and see the farm. It's a very unique program. It's designed specifically for people with autism. It's a nationally recognized, really signature program of ours, and we're just thrilled with it. And well, Jack is back at the farm with us. I want to let Mike tell you a little bit about the hike, because I mean, he's sitting here and Jack is one of our best hikers.
Yeah, Jack is one of my core hikers. I usually lead about 6 or 8 usually guys with me every Wednesday night, and we explore a different neighborhood of the city. Chicago is just such a rich rich city with all these different neighborhoods, different ethnic neighborhoods.
How many have you been to?
Don't have the number off the top of my head, but if you name a neighborhood, we've been there. We've been all the way up to Rogers Park and all the way down to Beverly and everywhere in between.
That's great. You know, Mike, I have to think, and I see in this studio, Natalie and Keith smiling too, that what you're doing is not only tremendous and enriching for the young people, it is also enriching for the parents, for you and Julie and for Keith and Nat. Shadowed by autism, that is the place to go. So thank you all. Thank you all.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Keith and Kelly.
No, my pleasure. We're now all buddies. And I want to see Jack, and I want to meet your son, John.
You'll see.
Jack and I talk to each other. It's a secret in our lives, but we talk to each other. Welcome back. Some time ago, I've been corresponding with a man who we share a mutual friend. He has written his first novel. It's one of these, and God knows I've had a lot of them on this show, all of them quite successful, these sort of late-in-life novelists. Mike, I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Is it Poel or Poel?
Poel-E. 3 syllables, Rick.
Poel-E. Got it. It's spelled
Poel-E, right.
Poel-E. It's a cool name. It's on the cover of his first novel, The Mithras Conspiracy. It is MJ Poel-E. Mike, let's talk, before we talk about this fascinating book, much of it's set in Rome, and it's kind of inspired by Da Vinci-like code mysteries, though I did not like the I like your book much more than I like the Da Vinci Code. How's that for a start?
That's a good start. I approve. yes. One thing I wanted to say, Rick,
sure.
I heard your show with Julie Tracy and Urban Autism Solutions.
Yeah.
And as the father of a 46-year-old, now adult, autistic son.
Wow.
I'm fully sympathetic with what they're doing. I think it's commendable.
Well, you must know, not to spend all the time on autism here, but you must know then and must have confronted when your son or child was, you know, becoming an adult, the lack of services and roads for that child, yes?
Absolutely, yep. Rick. You wouldn't believe 30 years ago when Dan was diagnosed, people didn't really even know what it was.
I know.
Some people were saying artistic. Isn't it wonderful how artistic he is?
Oh, wow.
So no one really knew what autism was. So the good thing is there's been a lot of improvement, and it's really good to hear people like Julie and others who are continuing the campaign.
Well, one thing to end this, I hope your kid's good, and I wish that... That they had been around and started this thing 40 years ago, so you could have taken advantage of it. Mike, you've had a fascinating pre-novel career. You are a local lad who went to Loyola Academy when it was still in Chicago, Loyola University. You graduated, and then, after a year abroad, went and graduated from Harvard Law School and wound up as a lawyer, and mostly as a professor of law. Did you enjoy that?
I did. I see my career as basically like two parts of the brain. The first part that I enjoyed was the left part of the brain, the analytical part. I had been a debater. I loved debate, loved politics, loved trial work, and So I enjoyed that part of it, and I especially enjoyed the teaching. Mm-hmm. I taught at Ball College of Law, and then most of my career is at John Marshall Law School.
Let me ask you, though, about writing. When, you know, everybody, and lawyers do, in just in the course of their working lives, a lot of writing. When did you start to get the fiction writing bug that has manifested itself in this fine first novel, The Mithras Conspiracy?
Well, I think it started out early with simply a love of words. I remember keeping a list of words when I was in high school, not looking them up. It was also the fact that at Loyola Academy, we had to read almost a novel a week in the English program. But I think my interest in fiction developed when Scott Turow gave a talk after 1L came out, 1977.
That was his first,
I was a professor at John Marshall Law School, and I thought, I was there. I experienced the things he did. I felt many of the things he did, but I didn't write the book.
Right.
So I thought, you know, maybe there's something beyond legal articles with footnotes. I call it a life without footnotes. And although that wasn't fiction in itself,
right,
it showed how a lawyer and somebody who was writing a prose book was gradually making the transition to being a novelist. And then along came Presumed Innocent,
yeah,
1987, a blockbuster book. And I think Scott Turow inspired me and I think other lawyers to give it a shot at novel writing.
Why do you think? I mean, you have John Grisham, too, and two of the best-selling authors of our era are former, well, I guess you're never former a lawyer. It's like being a Marine. What is it? Is there something inherent in the law that, I'm not saying all lawyers should sit down and start writing a novel, but those two are really good examples, I think. Is there something inherent in the way the law might make one think that lends itself to novel writing?
I think so. I think, you know, they're the obvious things that lawyers put a lot of time doing research.
Yep.
They're used to hard work.
Yeah.
Which you absolutely need. But that's not enough in itself.
No.
And I think the way I see it, when you're using the analytical skills of the left brain, it's everything's logic and reason. But that same quality of analysis, if it's used in a creative way, can be very helpful. Because, for example, lawyers deal with circumstantial evidence. We know certain facts, and then we infer or presume other facts. And that's what intrigued me about historical fiction,
yeah,
the Mithras Conspiracy, the story of an ancient manuscript that threatens the Italian government with a possible coup and raises questions about history and religion.
And religion, because Mithras was... and it's your book, but Mithras was an ancient religion, right?
It was. It was a type of Mithras was a type of savior god who showered benefits on mankind by slaying the bull. Some have seen that as a spiritual symbol of slaying the bull. Others as a more physical ritual. But in any event, the blood of the bull conferred benefits on mankind: the sunlight, the crops. And it became a very prominent cult in the Roman Empire and coexisted for about 200 years with Christianity.
Mm.
And there are certain similarities. In fact, Dr. Martin Luther King, when he was at theological school, wrote a paper comparing Mithraism with Christianity and noticing some of the similarities.
Now, one of the things that distinguishes your book, and it is very much, to my mind, a thriller with a very compelling main character who I think you told me somewhere that this is the first in what you hope to be certainly a second book with the detective,
right,
Marco Leone coming to the book ends, ladies and gentlemen. Well, with, well, I'm off to see Officer Jim Murphy. And he pulled Murphy's letter. He works for the Chicago Police Department, Office of International Relations. And you ask, one of the characters asked, will I see my American cousin in Chicago? Naturally, she linked her arm with his. You and I are family. But you, there is a, the setting, which is Italy, mostly Rome, you chose this, if I'm not mistaken, as a setting when you were honeymooning in Rome in 2004.
That's correct. The idea came to me, I think it was 2014. We were honeymooning in Rome, and the Da Vinci Code had come out, I think, the year before, 2013. And I realized what a stir that book made.
Oh, my God.
It's been, as you know, criticized by many literary scholars, the writing and the plot, whatever. But it occurred to me the reason the book succeeded, at least one of them, is it deals with questions that people are interested in.
Absolutely.
Or Stan puts it, where do we come from? What are we supposed to do? And where are we going?
Yeah, those grand metaphysical questions. Yeah.
Gets into religion and politics, and that's what the Mithras conspiracy deals with.
Yeah.
The intersection of politics and religion, and the force for good or evil that both can do.
Mike Poeli, we got to take a short commercial break, but I want to come back, and then I want to get into the plot of this fine novel, and how difficult it might have been, don't answer now, but how difficult it might have been to write, because writing a novel and getting a novel published is one of the grand, insurmountable adventures of the early 21st century. I want to figure out how Mike went about that. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm on the phone from warm, I'm assuming, Florida. First novelist. Mike Poeli, we had a number of mutual friends, but we'll get into that next time Mike's in Chicago when we sit down and talk face to face. He's written a fine first novel. The Kirkus Review calls it an enjoyable thriller that should make readers wonder what other parts of Italy the author could creatively mine. You do, and I'm assuming, Mike, in the Mithras conspiracy, spent not just a few honeymoon days in Rome, but you have a real feel for that city that I think cannot just come from outside research.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think there are two cities that have most impacted my life. One is Chicago,
yeah,
the city I grew up in, my native city. And then the city of Rome. I think largely because of my background, I had 6 years of Latin, was a major in history, traveled to Europe a number of times. So both of those cities have seized my imagination, that's correct.
Well, and it's interesting, this, and it must have been, how difficult was it, Mike, to write this book? I mean, it is, you know, you have an idea for a novel and you have some characters noodling around in your head and you have kind of a plot. Then you have to sit down and do it. What was that like for you?
Well, I guess it's Father's Day, and maybe it's, you know, it's kind of like having a child.
Yeah.
It's the anguish and the joy at the same time.
Sure.
But the bottom line is I enjoy it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't run for the right for the money. I would never do that because I think it's like buying a lottery ticket, frankly.
Sure.
Going the traditional publishing route.
Sure.
But fortunately, I don't need to.
Right.
I can follow my passion and my interest. And I think that made it easier for me, that I wasn't writing under a gun.
Yeah,
Of economic necessity. It's very difficult because, you know, basically, there are five large conglomerates that decide what gets published in fiction and what doesn't. And fiction has an uphill climb in the United States.
Oh, my God, terrible.
Nonfiction outsells it.
The other thing is you decided to...
But I enjoyed it, basically, and that's what keeps me going.
And you decided to become a writer when the publishing business was at its most chaotic and transformative, and unless you were Stephen King or the aforementioned Scott Turow or John Grisham, it's like almost impossible to get a novel published. You Also, I'm going to tell you an inspirational story. Some time ago, a guy called me. His name is Ronald Balson. He said, I've just had a book published. Would you read it? Maybe I'll come on the radio show. He did exactly what you did. He's still a working attorney. He's in his early 70s now. He published a book called When We Were Brothers, published it by himself. It then started to sell modestly through Amazon, eventually selling as many as 500 a month, which is a lot of books. He then, somehow a woman at St. Martin's Press got a hold of it, signed him to a three-book deal. He has now sold more than 400,000 copies of that book, and I hope the same fate, it's a crapshoot, but I hope the same fate befalls you, because this is a fine, fine, thrilling book. The next one you plan to set in Chicago, do you not, or am I misreading the end of this book?
Well, that's
completely
correct. My current book, by the way, is on Amazon and also it's Ingram Spark, both online sites, Ingram Spark and Amazon.
That's great.
Second book is laid in Chicago. That's correct.
You have a website too, do you not, Mike?
My website is MJ Polelli. That's P as in Peter, O-L-E-L-L-E.
.com.
My book has two hard words to spell. One is my name and the other is Mithras. Mithras is M-I-T-H-R-A-S.
Was it, how empowering was it, and satisfying and empowering, when you held the first copy of the Mithras Conspiracy in your hands?
It was like holding the first baby in your hand in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
It made it worthwhile, especially since I wasn't wasn't primarily or even secondarily really concerned about how quickly it was selling. I was just glad I was able to do it. It was kind of like a promise you make to yourself.
Yeah.
When I was practicing, I always had the excuse, I have to make a living, I have to teach my classes. When I retired, I was deprived of an excuse. And then I thought, well, the weather's kind of cold in Chicago. I don't feel like raiding. Uh-huh. Then I moved down here. It's very beautiful.
Yeah,
I was deprived of that excuse. So I ran out of excuses. That's what happened.
Yeah. So you wrote a book. How's the second one coming? It must be because I do. I mean, one of the things that I really sense, not only sort of the narrative, the inherent narrative drive that you possess, but also you really are, you know, Rome is a big element of the book. I'm going to assume that you are sort of joyfully working on the second and joyfully crafting things about Chicago in there.
I am. It should be a bit easier in this sense. You mentioned earlier about the research. My wife and I did spend a week in Rome just doing research on the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the most delightful times because I had seen Rome numerous times. We didn't need to do the usual tourist things.
Right.
So I was able to have an archaeologist conduct me to the sites I was writing about. And I was able to talk to the Polizia di Stato. The Rome police.
Rome police, sure.
I'm hoping when it comes to Chicago, I can rely a little bit more on my own experience.
And yeah, you went, I mean, part of the book, I don't want to tell too much, but there's a sort of nasty murder of a childhood friend of the main cop in this thing. And the childhood friend's a priest who works at the Vatican Library. Did you see the Vatican Library?
I did, yes.
What's it like?
It's very imposing. It's like coming into the closet of history.
Yeah.
All kinds of assorted things in helter-skelter fashion. Oh, it's overwhelming, really.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I think that caught my imagination. What else? What other mysteries are in this vast treasure trove called?
I sense I have never been to Rome, but the Rome that I experienced in your book is a very, very kind of dark and dangerous place. I mean, I'm sure the Rome Tourist Council wouldn't want to hear that. But that's the Rome that comes through in your book. It's a mysterious place. Was that your intention?
I think so. Partly because there's layer upon layer of history.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I remember seeing churches built over these old temples. And what were they? And that was my first introduction to the Mithras religion where hundreds of temples or underground caves, actually, they worshipped in underground caves, were built under the city and throughout most of the Western Roman Empire.
Had you ever heard of the Mithras religion before you started researching this project?
Only vaguely, and I really knew little about it.
Yeah.
But because of my interest in history and religion and my classical background, it became more interesting as I pursued it.
You sound like
similarities between the two. It's Martin Luther King noted in his research. Now, for some people, that's very scary, as it was for some of the early Christians.
Oh, I'm sure.
If we're too similar to other people, how are we really different?
Yep.
And others of the same religion say, well, that's a good thing, because we have a lot in common. But the fundamentals of human kindness, of goodness, are the same. There's constant tension.
And I appreciate you address those kind of big, big questions, those, large questions for which answers are elusive. Another thing that distinguishes your book in the 2 minutes we have left is these short chapters make it it helps the narrative drive. Was that intentional?
Yeah, it certainly was, Rick. I have to laugh because I grew up reading the classic books.
Yeah, me too.
In my first drafts, the chapters were very long.
Uh-huh.
And then a friend of mine said he likes to read fiction books before he goes to bed because they help put him to sleep, and he likes to read a short chapter. And I thought, well, there may be many reasons to read a book, but apparently people do like short chapters.
I know. It's a real trend in contemporary fiction. Mike Poeli, it's a pleasure to meet you on the phone. Let me know the next time you're in Chicago, and I'll have you live in studio.
Yeah, Rick, one final thing. This reminds me of the Midnight Express with Studs Terkel.
Thank you.
Thanks for a touch of old Chicago.
That's an honor. I can't wait to meet you face-to-face.
Hey,
good luck with the book,
The
Mithras Conspiracy.
Bye.
Well, that's almost the end of the show. You got to hear a few commercials, and I'll say goodbye.